Lobita, and this is the third of five sessions that are exploring the Columbus Quincentenary in the light of the Gospel of Mark. This is this third session is called "Are You Too Incapable of Understanding? Uncovering Cultural Myths." And the first of that comes from the Gospel text that we'll be using, which is Mark 7, 1 to 24. I think before we go into today's session, I'd like to review a little bit of the ideas that we've covered in the previous two sessions. Basically, as the underlying concept, we're looking at Columbus not just to look at the incidents of 500 years ago, but to looking at Columbus is far more than that. It's looking at a metaphor for ourselves, for our society. We're looking at Columbus as a way of looking at the myth, the stories, or the cultural myths that shape us as a people. And when I say cultural myth, I mean an underlying assumption, a belief, a way of thinking about the world that we take for granted, that we assume, that we probably don't even think about or don't even know that we have. Columbus is a fascinating opportunity to dig into and uncover some of those cultural myths that are a part of all of us because they're a part of our society. There were belief systems that enabled the conquest to take place, the conquest of the Americas, and many of those belief systems or cultural myths still are a part of our everyday living. In the first session, we looked at a piece of art, a painting of Columbus landing on Guanahani in 1492. And by looking at that painting, we identified some of the assumptions, the worldviews that were present for the painter as well as for the people in the painting. Can anyone remember some of the things that we pointed out from looking at that painting? Some of what we named cultural myths.
Europeans were in the foreground, much more prominent. Oh. The Indians were in the background, very dark,
okay,
barely visible.
They had like a holy light around them.
Okay, I'll repeat those two. One, that the Europeans were the prominent figures and the Indians were the barely visible figures. That the Europeans had a kind of halo or a glowing light, almost the blessing of God around them.
They carried a flag with a cross on another flag with probably the seal of the king and queen, and look at their mission was blessed. And
okay.
Intentions were.
Okay, those are two separate things. One, the unity of the cross and the crown in the painting, very, very boldly printed on the flag itself. And what you said, yes, the nobility of Columbus. Columbus, in almost all pictures of Columbus, is portrayed as very, very noble and very, very almost angelic in his purity, as intelligent.
A leader,
right. We named some of the myths, or people in the group here named some of the myths that were evident in that painting, such as that the white people had the right to that land, that the leader, Columbus, was a wonderful and fine figure, whereas the other men were kind of groveling for gold or fighting in the background. That being a myth of one leader, of an elite group of people being perhaps better than other people. In the second session, we looked at slides from textbooks and biographies of Columbus that kids read. And we went through maybe 50 different slides showing the way we learn, the stories that we learn about Columbus. And Columbus is portrayed as the reader, the child reader, gets to know Columbus very well from his childhood on up, his dreams, his desires, whereas the reader gets to know nothing about the Indians. The pictures show the Indians as savages or unintelligent, nonverbal people, whereas the Europeans are presented in a very different way. Many, many different slides. The Indians are called cannibals when there was no documentation of cannibalism. Heathens, pagans, savages. And all of this was simply to get at the way history is written and told shapes our idea of the world and shapes our ideas of how different races relate to and are to each other, shapes our ideas of power, shapes our idea of rights and human worth. We've also been studying, looking at the Gospel of Mark in the first session, looking at the two of the six boat crossings in the Gospel of Mark, and we set forth the idea that in the Gospel of Mark, the boat crossings, that the Gospel of Mark is written in two distinct halves, one in Gentile territory and one in Jewish territory, and that the Gospel of Mark continually shows Jesus subverting or defying, overturning the cultural norms of his day, the purity codes, the honor system that excluded people. So we looked at the boat crossings with the idea of them implying crossing over to the other side of humanity, to the marginalized side of humanity. And we looked at the calls that we sometimes receive or do receive to cross over to the other side of humanity, to marginalized people. And in each session, we've listened to voices of Native Americans and some African voices. I'd like to start this session by another reading. I think that, to me, it's very important that we don't talk about the quincentenary without listening to voices from Native people. So we'll open with a somewhat brief, but a little bit longer reading than before. It's a reading from Touch the Earth, and it is a letter from Mi'kmaq, who was an Indian chief in 1676. And it's a letter from him to a group of French captains in Nova Scotia. As we listen to the reading, I would ask that you simply listen intently and try to imagine the Indian chief writing this letter, perhaps imagine the listeners. There's a lot of humor in it, so don't hesitate to find the humor. Diane will read it. And Diane, I'm wondering if you could come over here just so the mic could pick it up.
What would be the year
of the reading? The reading is in 1676.
Thou reproachest us very inappropriately that our country is a little hell on earth in contrast with France, which thou comparest to a terrestrial paradise, inasmuch as it yields thee, so thou sayest, every kind of provision in abundance. Thou sayest of us also that we are the most miserable and most unhappy of all men, living without religion, without manners, without honor, without social order, and in a word, without any rules, like the beasts in our woods and forests, lacking bread, wine, and 1,000 other comforts, which thou hast in superfluity in Europe. Well, my brother, if thou dost not yet know the real feelings which our Indians have towards thy country and towards all thy nation, it is proper that I inform thee at once. I beg thee now to believe that all miserable as we seem in thy eyes, we consider ourselves nevertheless much happier than thou, in this that we are very content with the little that we have. Thou deceivest thyself greatly if thou thinkest to persuade us that thy country is better than ours. For if France, as thou sayest, is a little terrestrial paradise, art thou sensible to leave it? And why abandon wives, children, relatives, and friends? Why risk thy life and thy property every year? And why venture thyself with such risk in any season whatsoever to the storms and tempests of the sea, in order to come to a strange and barbarous country which thou considerest the poorest and least fortunate of the world? Besides, since we are wholly convinced of the contrary, we scarcely take the trouble to go to France, because we fear with good reason, lest we find little satisfaction there, seeing in our own experience that those who are natives thereof leave it every year in order to enrich themselves on our shores. We believe further that you are also incomparably poorer than we, and that you are only simple journeymen, valets, servants, and slaves, all masters and grand captains though you may appear, seeing that you glory in our old rags and in our miserable suits of beaver, which can no longer be of use to us, and that you find among us in the fishery for cod, which you take in these parts, the wherewithal to comfort your misery and the poverty which oppress you. As to us, we find all our riches and all our conveniences among ourselves, without trouble, without exposing our lives to the dangers in which you find yourselves constantly through your long voyages. And whilst feeling compassion for you in the sweetness of our repose, we wonder at the anxieties and cares which you give yourselves night and day in order to load your ships. We see also that all your people live, as a rule, only upon cod, which you catch among us. It is everlastingly nothing but cod. Cod in the morning, cod at midday, cod at evening, and always cod, until things come to such a pass that if you wish some good morsels, it is at our expense, and you are obliged to have recourse to the Indians, whom you despise so much, and to beg them to go hunting that you may be regaled. Now, tell me this one little thing, if thou hast any sense, which of these two is the wisest and the happiest? He who labors without ceasing, and only obtains, with great trouble, enough to live on, or he who rests in comfort and finds all that he needs in the pleasure of hunting and fishing? It is true that we have not always had the use of bread and of the wine which your France produces, but in fact, before the arrival of the French in these parts, did not the Gaspinians live much longer than now? And if we have not any longer among us any of those old men of 130 to 140 years, it is only because we are gradually adopting your manner of living. For experience is making it very plain that those of us live longest who, despising your bread, your wine, and your brandy, are content with their natural food of beaver, of moose, of waterfowl, and fish, in accord with the custom of our ancestors and of all the Gaspesian nation. Learn now, my brother, once for all, because I must open to thee my heart. There is no Indian who does not consider himself infinitely more happy and more powerful than the French.
I like that reading because it crosses or it goes against many of the stereotypes or the images we have of Native Americans of that time. Any responses to that or comments on it?
It's incredible that the man, the Indian at that time, would have the command of the language it is.
That's really incredible.
Well, it doesn't surprise me that we haven't heard that letter before. Mm-hmm. Because I think that that's the kind of letter that goes against, as Margaret Morgan was talking about this morning, the conventional wisdom. Mm-hmm. I mean, that would do, I think, one of two things. It would probably have the opposite of the desired effect that perhaps the Native American wanted, and that's mm-hmm. it would probably bring about rage.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
That we can't have this.
Say more what you said, what you meant by that it goes against the conventional wisdom.
Well, I think the only way that the Europeans or the French could come in and, quote, take over lands is by assuming that the people that lived there were savages.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And you have to demean people in order to take away their land.
Okay.
This obviously mm-hmm. is not a letter written by mm-hmm. a mm-hmm. person who is of low intellectual mm-hmm. capabilities. Mm-hmm.
So it goes against the prevailing belief of the Indian as savage. Right. Yes.
It reminded me too of your book, Rethinking Columbus,
because
it talked in there about that apparently the people who did lure the Europeans or the Americans that went across to the northern continent, the United States, wrote back about how fluent and how beautiful the language of the people who lived there was. But in our own children's stories, and I just, Peter Pan, the Disney version of that,
mm-hmm.
and I thought I might use it at school, and mm-hmm. I listened to it, and I couldn't mm-hmm. believe it. You know, mm-hmm. it says, there's a song, Why is the Red Man Red?
Uh-huh.
And they have the Indians going, ugh, and that's mm-hmm. the way they communicate. And so mm-hmm. often, when I was growing up, they would show things like that in the movies and books and things like that, and they're very stereotypical in the language that they use, whereas the language is actually very beautiful, metaphorical, and whatever.
So you both raise a very interesting question of why that story of the beauty of the language and this story are not stories told.
I was interested mm-hmm. that he said they lived to be 130 to 140 years old. That's just incredible. I don't think any Europeans certainly not the Americans have achieved longevity like that. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And of course, and you can hear the nail sounding in his letter there about, well, some of us have abandoned those ways and we don't have any more people who mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. to be that mm-hmm. old. And the wine and the brandy, mm-hmm. you know, it just makes you sick.
Mm-hmm. Last summer I met the oldest living American, and he's up in Alaska, an Indian, about 100, I think around 115 years.
Wow.
115? 115. I forget his name. Well, I should say I met his granddaughter.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I didn't meet the uh-huh. manager. I met his granddaughter.
Uh-huh. 115, and he's a Native American, Native Alaskan.
Yeah.
Huh. Given those comments and given that story, take a few minutes to brainstorm, and I don't mean, we don't need to debate these, but just brainstorm some of the images of Indians that you've grown up with. And don't be afraid to say things that sound ridiculous, because we've all grown up with Indian images of Indians that might sound ridiculous. And I'll just record some of what you say.
The red skin.
Red skin?
Okay. Speaking in monosyllables and grunts.
Uh-huh. All right, that's two. Red skin and speaking in grunts. All right. Others?
Dirty.
Mm-hmm.
Lazy.
Oh, yeah. Lazy.
Drunk.
Dirty.
Vicious.
Drunk.
Not trustworthy.
Vicious. All right.
Athletic.
Untrustworthy. Athletic. Any others?
I always liked, when I was a little girl, the pictures of Indians with their long hair and their long braids.
Uh-huh.
And I always wanted to be an Indian when I grew up so I could have long hair.
Uh-huh. Okay, long hair.
And
long
I'm braids. Still long to this day. It's even in the way.
Any others?
Romantic.
Romantic?
Warlike. You gotta get the cowboy and Indian movies up.
Warlike? Okay.
Every time I saw them in Europe to the movies, and they always lost, and
they always lost,
and they always scalped.
Yeah, kind of dumb.
Something
scalping.
Like,
scalping. Yeah, all
very
right.
Yeah. Cruel, I think.
Scalping, cruel. Always losing, you said.
Always kind of running into bullets. That's what I remember. It seemed like every shot that the cowboys shot, that it killed an Indian. Yeah, so it seemed like they were looking for bullets to run into.
Running into bullets, okay.
The perpetual losers.
All of my comments are positive because I'm part Indian.
Okay. What Indian nation are you from?
The Assiniboine Wahpeton Reservation in South Dakota.
Oh, really?
That's where I was born.
Oh.
A Dakota Indian.
That's fascinating. Then you should share stories with us. Yeah.
Knowing the animals.
These are just things that I remember as a child.
Well, I know.
Yeah. That's the word. Yeah.
Yes, so I think
don't
you know.
Don't misunderstand
that.
What we're
saying. Right.
Thank you.
I've heard the same things. I was told by a high school teacher looking right at me that Indians are dirty.
Right.
Well, I have always wondered why the history books.
Uh-huh.
Always depicted the Indian as bad and
uh-huh.
But they're weavers of blankets and pottery, and I think
yeah,
they craft work
and knew the animals that were so much.
Yeah, very natural.
Naturalistic.
Okay.
They lived in harmony with nature.
Yes.
Okay.
You know, one of my earliest memories of Indians though came from reading the James Fenimore Cooper books. And there was a real contrast of you had the good Indians and
uh-huh.
the bad Indians, and that
uh-huh.
there was, that was my first awareness that maybe the Indians would fight amongst themselves.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, that's all that I remember from the history books when I went to school. And then later in life, I became so partial to the Indians,
mm-hmm.
and blaming myself and my heritage
mm-hmm.
for coming over here and taking over like we did. I don't think that was right at all. And I couldn't blame the Indians for fighting for their rights.
You know, you made another comment just before that when you said, I always, wasn't it you that said, I always wondered why the history books portrayed the Indians as bad?
Yes.
Let's flag that, because I'd like to come back to that question. I think that's a really, that's one of the most important questions we can ask, I think.
The history books didn't put the Indian in any good light at all, as far as I remember.
Don't you think that was guilt? I mean, how can we teach the manifest destiny of America if we talk about taking away all their land and shuffling them across these mountain passes in the winter? How can we justify that? We've got to cover it up.
Is it?
I was saying that the reason the history books are that way is
in the past. I think guilt has something to do with it.
It's to exonerate us somehow.
Well, isn't America the only country which can say and not be proud of it that people came over here from other countries? That wasn't done well.
Australia did it worse.
Australia did it. Okay.
India.
Okay. And South Africa.
Yeah. There's other places where it was equally as bad.
Yeah, but for a minute I thought America was the only one, was exclusive in that matter.
Comment
but over. When I came, you know, this was when I lived in Austria, saw these movies and that. Two things when I came over here struck me. One of the, I did hear good things about Indians, how hospitable they were, for instance, when the pilgrims came. Mm-hmm. And also, I live in Seattle, Chief Seattle was very hospitable to the people. And the other thing that struck me was, I always saw them as warrior, and then I went on an Indian reservation, and it looked so sad to me. Mm-hmm. You know, it seemed like...
Their culture is gone.
Yeah, it was really sad to see that. After, even with the movies, you still had the feeling, you know, that they were good hunters and so forth, and then to see them. Mm-hmm. So it's such sad condition.
Well, your comment, I think, leads us to another question, and I want us to reflect more on the why. But before we do that, coming out of what you said about the movies, think for a minute about how these images were conveyed to us in our growing up years, in our adulthood. How did we get these pictures of images? You've named one, and what you named was the movies.
Mm-hmm.
Brainstorm again. Pardon me?
Television.
Okay,
books.
Movies, TV, books,
comics. You have a question, the movies, I think.
Comics. Cartoons.
Newspaper articles.
Commercials.
History books.
Okay, history texts.
Yeah.
As we saw yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
I think as a child, we can't underestimate the influence of our parents.
They
grew up the same way, our parents.
I don't know, because I'm not that much younger than most of you, and yet I didn't grow up with these images of Indians at all, and I don't know if it's because my parents very conscientiously shielded me or kept me from these things, or it's because we always knew people who were Indians, and if I saw something in a movie, I said, I know people, and they aren't like that.
I think that's not real common.
I think it's within the last 20 years that there's been a turn. That there's been, the Indian activism has been one of the key. And at least in my memory, the first thing that turned it around was the big turnaround in looking at Custer and seeing him as the aggressor and the evil person within the Battle of the Little Bighorn, what used to be called the massacre. But I think the dominant culture has kind of backed off on that one, and I think the information, all the information out about Custer, that at least in my mind was one of the first major, you know, pulling back of the myth.
One thing, just to follow this, when our son was about 5 years old, and we live in Pullman, and we went about 30 miles down to Lewiston, and we're just having a picnic at a park. I think we did floating in the river or something. We came back to the park, and it's in Ness Pierce Park there, and he went into the men's restroom, and I was in the ladies, and all of a sudden he came screaming and running out, and said, Mom, there's an Indian in the other bathroom. And I thought, wow, you know, where did he ever get that?
And all I could think was, you know, the cartoons, because I mean, he wasn't reading or anything yet, and cartoons, and I suppose things like maybe the Disney movies even, that you know, seemed so harmless at that time, and between all, you know, the Indians on the warpath and chasing the...
And they always had beautiful maidens.
Well, that's another good one.
Beautiful maidens. Well, they were always beautiful, weren't they?
That goes into a whole other area, too. Mm-hmm.
Well, somebody mentioned comics a little while ago. I have never read comics in my whole life. I'm 83 years old, and it kind of surprises me in a way, and I guess it doesn't surprise me, that you said that through the comics we get those poor images also.
You know,
that's what you meant?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I remember reading Lone Ranger comics.
Oh, yeah.
You know, and the...
Tonto.
And Tonto, you know. But the, yeah...
I would suggest, I know someone mentioned that, and it's true, someone mentioned the progress that has been made in overturning some of these images. And I think that's true. And you mentioned that growing up a younger generation, those images weren't as prevalent. But I would also suggest that they are very, very present and very prevalent. I collected a couple of things here just looking at advertisement. Calumet baking soda that's in all of our houses bears the Indian chief's head on it. Eskimo pies that we buy at 7-Elevens bear the Indians on them.
Washington Redskins.
The Washington Redskins.
I question, yes, though, is that demeaning? What do you mean by demeaning? That to have Eskimo pies and the Redskins? To me, that's saying
Swedish meatball.
They're warriors. Yeah, that's no more than any other ethnic.
That's a good question. How were you going to respond to that?
To me, that doesn't bother me. There are so many other issues that are really important to the Indians that's minor to me.
What I would say to that, and what I've heard from Native peoples also, is that demeaning might not be the word to use, but stereotype creating.
I think they're beautiful. Headdress on the Calumet baking powder is gorgeous.
Yeah, but maybe part of the difficulty with them...
It glamorizes it.
Okay. I would just say that part of the difficulty with that is that the image that it creates or the understanding that it creates in the minds of people, particularly young people. My son is 5, and he is of progressive parents who would never dream of overtly stereotyping, and yet I have heard him think that Indians wear headdresses like that. That's what an Indian is. And just
that's
to...
just our festival time. Remember?
But it's only one certain nation of them. It's not all the nations that wear them.
I guess I would just say that using Indians as advertising helps to create and perpetuate stereotypes that are often false. And that categorizing and stereotyping people is terribly limiting to really knowing people.
Well, and I've heard some people say that if you would, a good test of whether it's racist is, would you be comfortable, say, the Washington Jews, or to use a Jewish person or some other race or group like that on advertising? Of course not. And Native peoples are...
But it's still used. Look at them. What did the little Dutch boy sell? Paints. Mm-hmm. With his wooden shoes and his little blonde hair that comes across. Mm-hmm. Or who's the girl who has the beard? She's got 4 beards in her hands and kind of a low-cut dress. Come on, somebody.
German Pauli.
St. Pauli girl. She has German beard. And that's a very stereotypical image. You know, she's buxom and she's going to give you a beard.
Don't you think just having a California raisins happen?
Just being one nationality, you're stereotyped. For instance, I come from Austria, and everybody thinks I can cook and I yodel. And I
can you blow that out? No.
I think, however, go ahead.
Well, I think that gets into a whole other subject, and I think it's tangential. Mm-hmm. It's connected to the whole issue of how we view of what is advertising and what is it for, and how does it convince us to do things that we don't want to do. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know? And it's not just advertising, too. It is the way that you grow up and what you read in your geography books and history books. When I was 23 years old, I went to Europe for the first time, and I was expecting to see people wearing their native costumes in all these countries. I was expecting to see all kinds of things I didn't see. I was 23 years old. That's what I learned out of the books. Yeah.
I also think, though, that there is, I think there is a difference between Swedish meatballs, that was a good example you brought up, and the little Dutch paint boy, and the stereotyping that is done of Native people, Native American people, African American people, because in the latter two categories, those are people who have been tremendously oppressed and repressed by the dominant culture, and those are stereotypes become a function, not a function of, but a method of, or complicit with, oppressive social structures. And I think that stereotyping there is far more dangerous than if it contributes to maintaining terribly detrimental or oppressive social systems. The Norwegians are not an oppressed class of people in this country, and therefore it's less dangerous to categorize us as whatever we're categorized as. Pardon me?
Or Volusia Bride.
Right. But there's a tremendous difference between that and stereotypes that are part and parcel with the cultural destruction of a people.
Yeah, see, Volusia Bride is a festival and a tradition that's carried on.
Isn't the Indian war bonnet a festival time? I mean,
but it's not the Indians who are using it.
Right.
It's we, the culture is using it as a way of, you know, outside the context of the festival. That's a very holy piece.
Do Native Americans make any money off of
That's a good point.
No, not off of those advertising things.
Oh, maybe not off
of that.
I think, though, that there are some signs, at least in terms of children's television, that things are changing. And I remember last spring, Sesame Street, which my kids watch, and I'm in the room all the time, did a Big Bird, and some of the others went for about 2 weeks to Montana, to Crow Country, and it was the most beautifully done session where they really went, and they went to Crow Country, and it was, they went with a little boy who was going from New York to see, from Sesame Street, to see relatives in Montana. And it was beautiful. My sons were ready to pack up and move.
An excellent program that does that is Reading Rainbow.
Yes.
They take a book I'm trying to think, it's Tom Powell has written The Legend of the Indian Paintbrush, mm-hmm. and some of these integrators, they take them to that culture and show many things that aren't so stereotypical, just typical things that are happening during that.
And those are things that we really need to hold up and affirm and multiply and you know, write to Sesame Street and thank them, because those are very important. I think particularly with Native American people, the stereotyping that goes on now is so often not criticized, and therefore to affirm those examples is very important. I was at a play with my son 2 months ago, and lo and behold, I didn't know it, but the pre-piece. They did a little prep play ahead of time, and it was Peter Pan, and there were the Indians up there, you mentioned this, just going ugh, 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 and wearing headdresses, and I thought, now what's my task in front of me with my little boy, who is now seeing that as what Indians are. I also wanted to read just one other example of the ways that influence is still among us now and how it might affect Native peoples. This is written by an Indian girl. The town I mostly grew up in was big enough to have a Carnegie Library, one of those squat, blood-red brick buildings, and it was the treasure house of my childhood. I don't remember how old I was when I discovered the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, but I was intrigued by them and showed them to my dad. Somehow, I couldn't say just how he worked it, but we didn't take any of them home that day. A few years ago, tired of hearing, "What do you mean you haven't read the Laura Ingalls Wild books?" And still curious, I opened one and found out why my dad didn't check them out for me. In The Little House on the Prairie, for example, on page 137,
The naked wild men stood by the fireplace. Laura smelled a horrible bad smell. Their faces were bold and fierce. End of quote. And so on. Many years stand between the nowadays me and the round little girl with braids, who, when this sort of thing came up in the classroom, used to sit with dry mouth and pounding heart, head down, praying that nobody would look at her. But the feeling is the same. The heart begins to pound, the mouth goes dry. Only now the emotion is not sick shame, but rage. Just reading that excerpt sort of said for me some of the negative impact of stereotyping that we still have present with us in literature that we read today.
I guess that brings up a question for me that I guess I'd like to ask here is, is then what is our, I mean, there's some pieces of literature that are considered classics, that have racism, you know, sexism, they're really strongly, have real strong statements in them about that. What is our response to that?
Other people might have ideas. My response to that is that we use them. We read them to our children, and we help our children critique them. It's like if you allow your child to watch commercial TV, what is your response to the advertising? You can help your child critique it. So,
yeah,
I bet. But maybe it's the same with some of the classics that use sexist and racist imagery.
That would be my.
I think too, as your children are older, and some of the classics really are aimed at somewhat older children than say mine. But as you read them, you can put them in a setting and say, this. Our school district just had this big deal about Huckleberry Finn. And what some people were saying was, well, wait a minute. You know, we can use the book if we set some parameters and say, this book was written during this time period in this part of the United States, and go into some of the history of what was going on during that part of the United States history, which isn't necessarily the best part of our history we want to hold up and examine, but say, this is what was happening, and when this book was written, things were different than how we could see them now. And some people were comfortable with that, and some people wanted to ban the book anyway.
I think it's valuable, though. I mean, like the Laura Ingalls Wilder books, you can't ban them either, you know? I mean, I think it's a real, they're still good books. Kids love them, teachers love them, I've read them. But I think it is important to talk about frame of reference and the cultural milieu that they grew up in, you know? I mean, why did this author think that? I mean, to Laura Ingalls, that's how that Indian looked. I mean, those are basically biographical stories.
So, but what you're saying is similar to what you were saying, that it is very useful, and that to teach our children of any age to do social analysis, to critique, is enormously,
analysis.
And historical
that's
analysis.
To the same extent, now that's what we do in a lot of Bible studies. The Lutherans seem to, I'm Methodist, and we do that, and certainly the Bible studies and things I've heard here. The letters from Paul, for example, are put into context. They're not just taken necessarily at face value for what the writings, for what the words literally say, but are put into context and said, Paul was writing from this place, writing to this group of people. This is what was happening in the society.
One of the contexts of that is in terms of sharing with a child, like the excerpt you read from the Laurel or the Little House on the Prairie books is that the people as they were homesteading were basically homesteading on the lands that were were a part of the part of the open world of the Indian and closing them down, and that yes, they were angry, they were pretty upset that they were losing their hunting grounds.
So that just brings up another angle on teaching children to critique. Yes.
Yeah.
What you said is a nice lead for us to move to another area to do this inquiry, and that would be, you brought up Bible study. Let's take a little shift
and move to look at what the Gospel of Mark might have to say about systems or structures that exclude, that are exclusionary. How many of you were in the Bible study this morning? Almost half. The Bible study this morning was in many ways about the text that I'd like us to read now, and the comments that were made, yeah, it does blow me away. The comments that were made about it are very applicable to what I'd like us to dig into right now. Let's take a look. You can open your Bibles if you want to Mark 7, 1 through 24. This is the story of Jesus and the Pharisees, and Jesus comments on the Pharisees' purity codes. I'm going to read the part of the narrator, and would you mind reading the part of, of the disciple, of the scribes and Pharisees? Would you be doing that for me? It's this line right here.
Okay.
Why do you say it's not our traditional ancestors? Okay. I will be the narrator, she will be the Pharisees, and who is Jesus? You are Jesus, okay. The Pharisees and some of the experts in the law who had come from Jerusalem gathered around him. They had observed a few of his disciples eating meals without having purified, that is to say, washed their hands. The Pharisees, and in fact all Jews, cling to the custom of their ancestors and never eat without scrupulously washing their hands. Moreover, they never eat anything from the market without first sprinkling it. There are many other traditions they observe, for example, the washing of cups and jugs and kettles. So, the Pharisees and the scribes questioned him.
Why do your disciples not live according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with hands defiled?
And he said to them,
how accurately Isaiah prophesied about you hypocrites when he wrote, this people pays me lip service, but their heart is far from me. Empty is the reverence they do me, because they teach us dogmas, mere human precepts. You disregard God's commandment and cling to what is human tradition. You have made a fine art of setting aside God's commandment in the interest of keeping your traditions. For example, Moses said, honor your father and your mother. And in another place, whoever curses father or mother shall be put to death. Yet you declare, if a person says to their father or mother, any support you might have had for me is korban, that is, dedicated to God. You allow them to do nothing more for their father or mother. That is the way you nullify God's word in favor of the traditions you have handed on. And you have many other such practices besides. Hear me, all of you, and try to understand. Nothing that enters a person from outside can make them impure. That which comes out of them, and only that, constitutes impurity. Let everyone heed what they hear.
When he got home, away from the crowd, his disciples questioned him about the proverb.
Are you too incapable of understanding?
He asked them.
Do you see that nothing that enters a person from outside can make them impure? It does not penetrate their being, but enters their stomach only and passes into the latrine.
Thus did he render all foods clean. He went on.
What emerges from within a person, that and nothing else, is what makes them impure.
Thank you. In Jesus' day, purity and honor codes functioned to create and maintain group and social boundaries. Later they were used throughout the book of Leviticus, rather specific laws are delineated that separate the chosen people from others around them. Later, those codes were used to exclude people from acceptable society. Many of those codes had to do with the ritual purification of food before eating. Sectors of society were considered pure and others were impure. Women, people who were not whole, people who were poor, were impure. Blood, the touching of blood was impure. Those codes served and functioned in ways that marginalized. Can we think for a minute about ways that the rituals of purification that were just read about might have marginalized or excluded some people?
I was surprised when Mr. Borg was talking about mm-hmm. this same thing, and he said mm-hmm. the doctors weren't pure. Mm-hmm. And that, I had never thought, I mean, of all the people, I mean, in our society, we think of the doctors as being the ones that are most scrupulously clean. So that was just a real insight to me. Well,
I would think of anyone who, probably poor people, given the fact of all of the ritual bowls and dishes and that kind of stuff that you needed, and if you only had one, mm-hmm. it would be difficult to do all the process.
Or if you didn't have water. And yeah, imagine that code of honor, that purity code involving the washing was inaccessible to the poor population of people. Imagine the exclusive nature of that those people then could not live up to the religious code of honor.
No matter how religious they were.
Right. Other thoughts about that or reflections, taking again into consideration the words of this morning also?
I think, I don't know if they had a homeless problem, but certainly homeless people or people mm-hmm. people with what we call, you know, developmental disabilities, the inability to to function totally effectively, and people without families.
Mm-hmm. People without families, yes. It was Jesus, in this text, Jesus says, thinking about what Jesus says, Jesus is overturning that code, that centuries-old code. What Jesus is doing is radical, and as Marcus said this morning, is subversive, to say that purity has nothing to do with what we put in us. In other words, with the carrying out of the codes, the carrying out of, as he called it this morning, the conventional wisdoms of the day, that purity has to do with what is within the person. In other words, in this text, Jesus is, as in many, many of the, particularly the Markan texts, Jesus is overturning, is breaking through the boundaries and the laws that exclude sectors of society in his day. He is inviting into the king, he is demonstrating or bringing forth the kingdom of God, which includes all rather than excludes. In the texts that we studied earlier yesterday, Jesus touches and heals the impure woman who is bleeding before attending to the daughter of the religious leader, the daughter of Jairus. There again, breaking through, breaking down codes, exclusionary codes.
But we still have them in churches today. You know full well that churches cater to a set group of people. And if you don't meet those guidelines, and you don't have rules passed out with the bulletin or anything, but still, it's fairly obvious who's welcome within a church community and who you just assume not be there.
So you're saying that today we have our own forms of codes or beliefs that exclude.
And they're quite effective.
You're made to feel like
dress codes?
To some extent. Now, my church is, we're in the middle of the desert, and you can pretty much go to church wearing just about anything as long as you're covered. But some churches I know are, you know, if you don't dress up, or I don't even own nylons, in some churches that would be strange. Some churches are very uncomfortable. Some churches are so lily white that if a person of color came in to worship in that congregation, although they might say, oh yes, of course, you're welcome, I'm not sure how comfortable that person would be. Mm-hmm. I've been in church, I have two small, young, noisy boys. We've been to church services where no nursery was provided, mm-hmm. or no Sunday school, or no child care was provided, mm-hmm. and I didn't feel very welcome having to deal with two children in the pew next to me who were wriggling around and squirming. And those are small things. And look at the bigger issues of society. people with AIDS aren't welcome into too many church congregations. People who are homeless. Now, our church does have homeless people come in every Sunday, and I don't know if it's for the sermon or for the coffee afterwards, but we have usually 3 or 4 people come into our church every day. A lot of churches are not built to accommodate people in wheelchairs or with different types of handicapping conditions. My grandpa's church has a service for Anglos. There's about 6 of them that go to church every Sunday. He is in a Hispanic area. His church has not done anything with the Hispanic population. It's about 95% of the neighborhood. Yet they're clinging for, and the average age of his church is about 80, I think, of Anglo white people who are in a little conflict. And pretty soon they'll all die off, and I don't know what the church will do. I suppose it'll close down instead of.
And then it'll start over with a new congregation.
Well,
and I think
possibly,
it's.
Possibly, that would be good, because it's this big, huge, huge building that has about 8 to 10 people at worship on Sunday morning.
I think it's very important that we, as Christian people and as people of the church, point out, note the exclusionary codes or beliefs within our own churches and try to begin to overturn them. I think it's also very important to acknowledge where and the many ways in which we are already doing that, because in many churches and in many places that effort is going on.
Oh, sure. But not everywhere.
No, and it can't go on until we, as you've just been doing, until we acknowledge it and point it out. Take a minute to think also about our society beyond the church. Think just for a minute about, back to the issue of racism, about beliefs or manifestations of beliefs that, I guess I would just like to say that I think we believe as a society that white is better. On some level, we believe white is better, white is more trustworthy, white is more honorable, white is probably more capable. And I'd like us to take a few minutes just to think about where we see that belief manifest. Maybe I'm wrong, I don't think I'm wrong. Can you perhaps dig into your own experience on that one for a minute?
Mixed marriages.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay.
My brother's here in the village, and my sister-in-law. And they have a racially mixed marriage. And my goodness, I thought my grandmother was going to have a heart attack when Paul said he was going to marry Ruth. Ruth is the most wonderful person you'd ever want to meet. She was the best thing that Paul, marrying her was the best thing Paul's ever done. And my grandmother can't get past that Ruth is of a different ethnic background.
Other examples? Thoughts on that one? Ways that you've seen or experienced that belief living in our society?
Well, I know I myself, I hate to admit this, but when I'm walking down the street, if it's later at night or something and I'm alone, I get more scared when there are people of color walking mm-hmm. towards me. Uh-huh. I know, and I hate that. Uh-huh. I hate that fear comes up more than it would if those were white people walking towards me.
And you hate, I mean, what's good is that you know it and that you hate it, because those are the first steps of mm-hmm. overcoming that. Mm-hmm. Good. Other examples? Yes.
Yeah. In Southern Arizona, of course, a lot of Chicano population there, and I think people prefer, at least the whites prefer, to hire a white rather than a Chicano, because they can converse better with them, and I think that the attitude is sort of shiftless, so you can't really depend on them to show up when mm-hmm. you want something done. Mm-hmm.
That's a good example. Yeah. Any others?
The kids might English.
Let me just see if there's anyone else. Yes.
The English-speaking kids in my class sometimes at the beginning of the year complain that the Spanish-speaking kids are talking about them.
Ah, interesting.
And uh-huh. so I go and translate, and I say, they're not talking about uh-huh. them. This is what they're talking
but
about.
But they think they're talking about them.
At the beginning
them.
Of the year.
Uh-huh.
That's a great people.
Bruce.
Okay, I taught for a couple of years in Flagstaff, Arizona, and a third of the high school were Navajo Indians. So mm-hmm. their concept of time, this was before I really didn't have an awareness mm-hmm. of these kinds of issues, and I remember being real frustrated mm-hmm. with their lack of concept of time. Mm-hmm. I mean, they would come in mm-hmm. 7, 10, 15 minutes mm-hmm. late, and mm-hmm. it was just, it's in their culture, time does not have a central focus, and therefore my view of them was that they were irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It took me a while to begin to appreciate within the Navajo culture how time, they don't even have a word.
Mm-hmm. Those are good examples. I think it's just enormously important that as we walk through daily life, as we live in, as we just live every day of our lives, we see within ourselves and within the society around us that belief coming present, because the only way to start to change that belief is to see it. I've seen it in myself. I've seen it loudly and clearly, and I've listened to some of the stories of African-American colleagues. Maybe to just share one or two, the woman, the professor, college professor, who told me that every time a black African-American goes into a department store, many, many department stores have buzzers, and the clerks push the buzzer at the clerk stand, and that buzzer indicates that a black man has come into the store and everyone's supposed to be watching for shoplifting. Or the African-American...
They do that with kids, too.
Oh, do they?
Teenagers.
But that's a good point. It doesn't mean it's okay to do it with black people. No. That's interesting. I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah.
Another example of another African-American professor I was with college people in this one, jogging past a 7-Eleven store, and splat, he's up against a wall with the police putting him up against the wall. Because he was a black man and he had run past a 7-Eleven, the assumption was he had robbed the 7-Eleven. And there are countless stories. Well, he should have sued. There are countless stories, and it brings to mind, you know, the activities in Los Angeles this summer also. And I bring that up because I think that it's part and parcel with the story of Columbus. I think the concept that the European was better than the Indian at that point is a myth that is still with us, and that we are, it is incumbent upon us, particularly as Christians, to note those myths and defy them. There's an image that I had once of a sea monster. It was a sea monster coming up. I was in a small boat on the water, and the sea monster was coming up to overturn the boat, and the boat would have been smashed. And at the last minute, I saw the sea monster and turned and grabbed it, and the sea monster turned into a seahorse and pulled the boat along. And to me, that's a story of how there are demons in our lives, personally and society, and one of them is the demon of racism, and that it will continue to destroy unless we look at it and grab it, and somehow let cultural difference and cultural reality move us forward as a society instead of destroying us. I'm wishing we had some time to kind of talk about next steps, and we don't. Our time is just about up. I'd like to make one suggestion, for other ways we can take steps to face and start to overturn racism in our society. And one of the things I would suggest is just that we listen, that we begin to listen to the voices of people of color and of poor people, rather than talking at or talking to, or even rather than helping, that we just set up the task of listening, which is sometimes very hard and can be very frightening. Any examples from you folks, from any of us, of listening that we've done that has made a difference?
I was just thinking about, I taught summer school this year,
mm-hmm.
And in our community there's a lot of Hispanics who come up as migrant workers, and they send their kids to summer school while they're out in the fields, and a lot of them are just, they go home on the bus, and they're either alone or they have a grandparent who watches several families until the parents get home from the fields. But I what you said about listening, I think is really neat, because I made some good friends with these kids.
Mm-hmm.
Summer school's a little looser than during the school year, and you have a little more time, I think, than during the school year. You've got so much that you have to do, mm-hmm. that it's hard to have time to where you just sit down with the kid and listen to them talk and see what their interests are and concerns. And it was really enlightening to hear these kids talk about their lives and what's going on and in their families.
Thank you. Another way of listening, obviously, is reading. Reading the voices, reading the words of other people. Let me close with one little piece of listening, a poem written by a Latin American. It's from Clandestine Poems, the book Clandestine Poems. I, like you, love love, life, the sweet charm of things, the celestial landscape of January days. Also, my blood boils and I smile for the eyes that have known the burst of tears. I think that the world is beautiful, that poetry is like bread for everyone, and that my veins don't end in me, but in the unanimous blood of those who fight for life, for love, for things, for landscape, and bread, who fight for poetry for everyone. That poem can be our closing prayer.